From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. You might be breaking a North Carolina law without even knowing it. That's thanks to the problem of over-criminalization. A national expert shares his insights about the topic. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush recently offered North Carolina leaders some ideas about education reform. You'll hear highlights from his remarks. A North Carolina congresswoman is leading the latest campaign against unfunded federal government mandates. You'll learn why. And we'll discuss the State School Boards Association's latest trip to court to get more money for North Carolina's public schools. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
United States Senator Bernie Sanders and New York congressional candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are emerging stars in the Democratic Party. They describe themselves as socialists, but the question is, are they really socialists? Dr. Roy Cordato is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. He writes at realclearpolicy.com that there is really no evidence they really are socialists, and he's here to explain why and what the difference is. Roy, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Donna.
Okay, so we are hearing and reading a lot of things that say the Democratic Party is moving to the left. Mm-hmm. In fact, that socialism is now part of a growing wing of the party. But you say, not really. Why not?
No, I would argue that what they are sort of unabashed welfare statists. Okay. That they fully embrace the welfare state and want to expand it to pretty much, every aspect of both our economic and our private lives. But they're not socialists. Okay. Now you say, well, how is that?
Yeah.
Well, traditionally, socialism, has meant to some degree or another, the nationalization of industries, government owned, industry. Okay. The government owns the means of production. If you, look at traditional definitions of socialism, that's what it says.
So you're meaning things like, say, a government owned airline.
Sure. Government owned airline.
Auto company.
Exactly.
Okay.
And in fact, if you look historically, the quote, great socialist nations, right? Like North Korea and Venezuela and Cuba and the USSR, and China, nationalized industries. And not only those, but you say, well, those are dictatorships and stuff, but even Britain, after World War II, they elected a socialist government. What did they do? They started nationalizing the energy industry, the iron industry, the coal industry, and the healthcare industry. Neither Sanders nor Ortez really haven't advocated doing any of that. I mean, they're not saying let's nationalize Google. Right?
I think they've talked about what they call Medicare for all.
Right.
And would that get closer to it then?
Well, it's interesting because people call that socialized medicine. Medicare and Medicaid are single payer systems. They're not socialized medicine. Okay. In Britain, they have socialized medicine. The government owns the hospitals. The government owns the means of production in a socialist system. In healthcare, it would mean what Britain has. Government owns the hospitals. Doctors are government employees and so on. This is a means of – this is payment, okay? So the government is taking over the payment system, but they're not owning the means of production. The hospitals will still remain – private, quasi-private, nonprofit, whatever they are, doctors will continue to work for whoever they work for, but won't be government employees. Really, the model, if they want socialized medicine, the model is the Veterans Administration, okay, the VA hospitals. VA hospitals, socialized medicine. They are owned by the government. Doctors are employed by the government. The administration of those hospitals are government employees and so on. That is socialized medicine. What they really should be saying is we want VA for all, okay? Right. Not Medicare for all, if they truly want socialized medicine. This is why I say they are extreme in to the extent that they want government control and a very expansive, unvarnished welfare state. But that is not socialism.
What's interesting, Roy, is that you go on in the piece that you wrote for realclearpolicy.com, also available at johnlock.org, that there is a term for the views of Senator Sanders and congressional candidate Ocasio-Cortez. What is it?
Well,
before can you pronounce it? That's the first thing.
Exactly. Well, before I tell you what the term is, let me tell you how I came across it. I was doing some research on the economics of fascism. And what I kept coming across is this word, which describes the nature of all the fascist economy, Mussolini in Italy, Hitler in Germany, and so on. And the word is a French word. It's dirigisme, D-I-R-I-G-I-S-M-E. And dirigisme basically refers to a system where property titles and the means of production are in private hands, okay, in the sense that title to the companies and so on are private. But it's government making all the decisions, okay? So government directs production. Government may even set wages or at least have a strong influence on what wages would be.
And therefore, government would also predetermine almost the profit or loss of those privately owned companies.
Yes, well, because they'll be directing what they think should the direction they think the resources should go. On a very broad scale. Now, let me say, we do that, right? When we have subsidies for companies to come into North Carolina or whatever, we're doing that exact same thing, obviously on a much smaller scale. Somebody like Bernie Sanders wants to basically put that in place on a grand scale. Now, it's the approach that was used by Franco in Spain, Mussolini in Italy. But it's, as I say in the paper, it's ideologically neutral, right? It is a system where you use the power of the state to advance the goals of the state through the economy. Okay, so it doesn't matter what those goals are. They could be fascist goals or they could be extreme progressive goals, as they are with Sanders and the people who are calling themselves socialists. But the fact of the matter is, it is not a system where industry is generally nationalized.
And therefore, it's not socialism
right,
per se.
Exactly. Mussolini did not nationalize industry in Italy. Okay, he directed it and sort of made sure what got produced was what the state wanted produced and how it got produced and all that. But in general, it was not a system where they nationalized industry. And that is in large part what the so-called socialists are advocating in the Democratic Party.
Let's talk a little bit more about these emerging stars. Bernie Sanders, of course, a holdover from the 2016 presidential election. Mm-hmm. And now this new person on the scene, and she's out of New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What would be the impact, just based on your general assessment of knowing what their views are, what would be the impact if we were to implement their views on – the economy, for example?
Well, I mean, the impact would be dramatically less growth. I think most of their goals would not be accomplished in terms of if their goals truly are to lift to help the poor and the lower classes, I think what they would do is ultimately make everyone worse off, including the people they're trying to make better off.
It's a fascinating piece that Dr. Roy Cordato has written. You can find it at realclearpolicy.com and at johnlock.org. Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez are not socialists, is the headline, so what are they? Roy, it's a great piece, and we encourage everyone to read it. Thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Are you a criminal? One suspects that most of you are answering no. But our next guest will help us address the possibility that many of us might be breaking state laws and we don't even know about them. James Copeland is Senior Fellow and Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. He has studied the problem of overcriminalization in North Carolina. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So first of all, before we get into some of the details of your research, when we're talking about this general topic of overcriminalization, as I just mentioned, what are we talking about?
We're really talking about a couple things. One is the multiplication in the number of things that are considered criminal. The sort of traditional things we think about when we think about criminals are murder, rape, assault, robbery. I mean, everyone knows these are bad. But these so-called malum prohibitum offenses, or things that are prohibited because they're against regulatory codes, aren't so self-evidently wrong. Not turning in the right form, not posting the right sign. And these have multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. And at the federal level, estimated more than 300,000 federal crimes. And we started saying, well, let's look at the state level. We think maybe this is happening at the state level too. So I looked first at New York, where the Manhattan Institute's located, and then I looked at North Carolina, and lo and behold, we see the same thing here.
So when you're talking about the term that you used, which I heard and said, I don't think many of our listeners have ever heard this term before, what you're talking about is something that would have normally we think is a government rule, and this is somehow turning into a crime.
Yes, exactly. The Latin term I used, unless they saw the movie Legally Blonde, wouldn't be on the lips of anyone who didn't go to law school. But these are wrong, not because they're inherently bad, like robbery, but because they violate a government rule. And there may be reasons for these rules, but traditionally, you had to have a guilty mind as well as a guilty act to be guilty of a criminal offense. That's been eroded over time at both the federal and state level. So innocent individuals, small businesses, family farms can get themselves into trouble without even realizing they're doing anything wrong.
And is this as much a problem in North Carolina as you feared it might be when you started looking into this?
Unfortunately, yes. And as it is with the federal level, it's actually impossible currently to figure out what is criminal in North Carolina, to actually total all the crimes. But one thing we did and used a methodology developed by Jeff Welty, who's a professor at the School of Government at UNC Chapel Hill, was look at the criminal code in North Carolina. And we found that that code has 765 sections, which is more than five times as many as the model penal code that the American Law Institute developed. It's also 55% larger than Virginia's and 38% larger than South Carolina's. So we said this is something the legislature ought to think about. But that doesn't even capture all the crimes, because there's a lot of crimes in other statutes in North Carolina that aren't in the criminal code. And when we looked at the new rate of crime creation that the General Assembly was doing, they were creating more than 34 new crimes a year. And in fact, the last year we counted in 2016, they created more than 80 new crimes. But the majority of these new crimes aren't in the criminal code. They're somewhere else. They may be in the fish and wildlife or the environmental laws or the health laws. So it's very difficult for people to figure out if they're doing something wrong. Now, granted, a big business with a team of lawyers, in-house counsel, and fancy law firms, they can figure out the rules more or less. But that doesn't leave a lot of hope for the small business, the entrepreneur, the family farmer. And those are the folks that often create the most jobs.
We are chatting with Jim Copeland, Senior Fellow and Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. With a criminal code that's that large, and with crimes that are outside the criminal code and elsewhere in the general statutes, is it possible for anyone, even the people who know the most about the law in North Carolina, to have a good sense of just what is legal and what isn't legal in the state?
I would say no. Obviously, trained lawyers that work in a specific specialty will have a pretty good idea about what's legal and illegal in their specialty. But actually just reading through all of these, and it's important to understand, even if you understood everything in the statute books in North Carolina, that wouldn't cover you. Because a lot of laws create regulatory authority with various state agencies and commissioners, and their rules become automatically criminal. And in fact, even professional licensing boards, and we need some of these licensing boards in certain areas. I think we overdo it, but in areas like healthcare, medicine, dentistry, obviously we need certain licensing boards. But a lot of times the state gives the rules of these licensing boards criminal effect as well. What that means is you've got lots and lots of crimes in North Carolina that the legislature itself never even voted on and may not be aware that this is actually something that's considered criminal under their own state's laws.
Okay, so we've spelled out a problem. There are lots of crimes, including lots of crimes that no one even has any awareness of. What do we do about it?
Well, we lay out in our reports some ideas, but one I want to focus on here today is one that certain members of the General Assembly have really gotten jump-started, but it hasn't happened yet. And Dennis Rydell, a representative from Alamance County, has taken some of the lead on establishing a recodification commission of the criminal code. Now, it's sort of an axiom in my line of work. Well, if you want to really kill an idea, set up a commission. So this commission has to be set up properly. You have to have the right people on it. It has to have real deadlines, and it has to have come up. Its recommendations need to be taken seriously by the legislature once it does that. But if you could actually clean up the code, getting rid of the crimes that don't make any sense, those that involve borrowing mules and things from the agricultural era, those that aren't used, making some of the crimes that are currently crimes actually civil offenses, making sure that the intent provisions are right in all the code, and finally just making it organized so that someone could try to figure out what's criminal and what's not, what's against the rules and what isn't, that could go a long way. So I hope the state will give that some due consideration.
Is there any potential positive impact, say, economically, to fixing this issue?
Oh, I think so. It's part and parcel of the reform agenda that's been going on that I think been quite positive overall here in North Carolina, you know, reducing tax rates, but in a responsible way where the fiscal budget looks good and paring down regulations. But when you come down to criminal law, I mean, criminal law has a bit more bite than just a civil regulation. And again, it's the small business owner, it's the entrepreneur, it's the family farmer that's not going to be able to figure these things out. And there's a lot of evidence out there that these really create jobs. I mean, if you look at some of the fantastic job growth here in the Research Triangle Park, I mean, a lot of the jobs have been created by companies that didn't exist 20 years ago. Well, if you've got a criminal code that puts entrepreneurs in jeopardy, you're discouraging precisely that type of behavior that generates economic growth for the whole state.
When people hear about this issue, do they generally come on board fairly quickly and say, yeah, we need to do something about this?
I think so. I think once people understand what we're talking about is the proliferation of business crimes. We're not talking about letting violent criminals back out on the streets. And in fact, the Manhattan Institute, where I work, is known for helping to clean up the violent crime in New York City. But when they realize that we're talking about making this more comprehensible, and granted, let's say some of the folks, the more progressive leaning people out there, think, oh, we really need to regulate business more, but let's do it in a logical way and in a way that gives people notice.
Jim Copeland, Senior Fellow and Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has modeled many of its recent education reforms on those adopted in Florida. That's good news to former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. He recently addressed this state's leaders during a luncheon event in Raleigh.
If North Carolina joined us on that journey a long time ago, where we were 50th in the graduation rate in 1998, and you had the same kind of gains that we've had on the NAEP test for 8th grade and 4th grade reading and math, you'd be number one in the country. You'd be ahead of Massachusetts in 4th grade reading and 4th grade math. That should be what we call in Florida a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal. That should be the aspiration of North Carolinians that believe in the state and believe that great things can happen. You should be number one. And with the reforms in place, with a concerted effort to make them happen, maybe converting a governor along the way to be a partner in this, certainly you've got a great superintendent that's an extraordinary partner, and getting the business community involved and getting political and business leadership and civic leadership involved, you could achieve it.
Bush says good data can help North Carolina adjust its education programs to meet students' needs.
We didn't always get it right the first time, but our legislature was extraordinarily visionary. Phil Handy, who was the chairman of the State Board of Education, was a big proponent of this and was successful in getting the money over a long-term basis to follow the child, to measure how children were doing pre-K to life, in effect. In Florida, you can tie student learning to where they go to college. You can tie student learning to the teachers, how successful they are with like-kind students. You can look at the schools of education in our state and see which beginning teachers have the best learning gains for low-income kids or for kids on average or whatever it is. We have all these tools, and they're very effective to be able, just as a business uses data to be able to drive its strategies through the enterprise, we were successful in using that data across the board. And what we found, and I would start with one of the tools that we had that still exists is the first week of kindergarten. In every kindergarten class in Florida, you have an assessment of where students start. Now, if you can customize the learning experience and you have trained teachers that know how to teach reading, you can catch up pretty quick. But you can also measure if they're at home learning to read when they're 3 and 4 years old, or if they're in a public setting or a private setting. Having that data actually can help drive policy in a very effective way.
That's former Florida Governor Jeb Bush speaking recently in Raleigh. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A North Carolina congresswoman is leading the fight on Capitol Hill to strengthen rules against unfunded mandates. Republican Representative Virginia Fox recently debated the issue on the U.S. House floor.
In 1995, Congress passed the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act, or UMRRA, to prevent the imposition of burdensome and costly federal unfunded mandates. Over the course of this Congress, the Oversight and Government Reform Committee has developed a record that clearly shows UMRRA has fallen short of its original goals. Last year, the committee saw input on UMRRA and received several hundred responses from governors, state legislators, and county officials regarding the impact of federal laws and regulations. Too often, state and local governments are confronted with the rotten choice of raising taxes on their residents or cutting services residents depend on in order to cover costs to comply with federal mandates. Unfunded federal mandates strain state and local budgets and subvert the principles of American federalism. Federal agencies treat states as servants to their regulatory whims rather than as partners to consult before imposing new burdensome mandates.
Fox has put forward House Resolution 50, the Unfunded Mandates Information and Transparency Act.
H.R. 50 will improve the quality of regulatory and legislative analysis and close the current loophole, which allows an agency to bypass UMRRA analysis by not issuing a notice of proposed rulemaking. According to the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office, 35% of major rules are issued without a notice of proposed rulemaking. That means more than one-third of the regulations with the greatest impact on the economy are excluded from UMRRA's cost-benefit and other analyses. H.R. 50 also expands the definition of direct costs to ensure economic analysis considers foregone profits, costs passed on to consumers, and behavioral changes. Requiring federal regulatory agencies and the Congressional Budget Office to include all anticipated costs in cost estimates will help ensure that analyses are complete and provide an accurate description of the full effects of regulations and legislation. H.R. 50 enhances transparency, accountability, and communication between the federal government and state, local, tribal, or private sector partners.
Fox explained how her bill would improve the federal government's current process for creating rules.
H.R. 50 requires federal agencies to engage in a more thorough regulatory process by codifying key provisions of President Clinton's Executive Order 12866. These principles were reaffirmed by President Obama in Executive Order 13563 and are consistent with President Trump's executive orders on regulatory reform. Under UMRRA, agencies are required to consult with state, local, and tribal governments when developing significant regulatory mandates. H.R. 50 extends this requirement to the private sector, which is similarly burdened by unfunded federal regulatory mandates. The bill also requires independent agencies like the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, and the Federal Communications Commission to comply with UMRRA.
That's U.S. Representative Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina, and champion of the Unfunded Mandates Information and Transparency Act. Fox explained another benefit of the legislation.
H.R. 50 extends judicial review to help ensure agencies carefully consider the least costly and least burdensome regulatory alternative, giving courts the authority to stay regulations for noncompliance with UMRRA. These changes are critical to achieving what Congress set out to do when UMRRA was passed in 1995. Requiring greater transparency and improving analysis prior to imposing federal mandates is not a partisan goal. State and local governments, headed by Republicans and Democrats alike, are affected by unfunded federal mandates. Businesses throughout the country have invested time and resources to comply with federal mandates. With such a sweeping impact, any decision to impose a federal mandate should, at a minimum, be transparent and based on the most comprehensive and accurate information available.
Critics contend the unfunded mandates legislation could roll back too many federal rules. Fox has a response.
We've often heard that the most dangerous words or the most dangerous phrase in the English language is, we're from the federal government and we're here to help. You know, I agree with that. Everywhere I go in my district, I hear from people, it isn't the laws that we pass, it's the regulations that implement those laws that are the biggest problems. Unfortunately, many of our colleagues on the other side of the aisle believe that government bureaucrats are the smartest people in the world. In fact, they are smarter than the majority of the American people who make this country great. We absolutely do not want to do away with all rules and regulations. We want safe food. We want safe drinking water. We want all of those things that help make this country great. But we want to bring some common sense and some transparency to the regulatory process.
Fox says her bill would help reduce the federal government's burden on people and their state and local governments.
We've heard time and again of the burdens the federal government imposes on state, local, and tribal governments. We've also heard from businesses throughout the country, both large and small, who have to forego investments in employees and infrastructure in order to comply with these mandates. Congress passed the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act in 1995 to require the federal government to think twice before imposing unfunded mandates. And let me say that bill passed, I believe, with unanimous support from both the House and the Senate. If not unanimous, it was overwhelming, over 400 votes in the House, and I believe 98 votes in the Senate. Of course, in the 23 years since passage, the bureaucrats in the federal government have found ways around many of those requirements.
Fox recapped her argument in favor of H.R. 50, the Unfunded Mandates Information and Transparency Act.
The GAO has reported that 35%, more than one-third, of major rules are issued without a notice of proposed rulemaking so that the public has no idea what is coming out in the rulemaking in advance. It's time to make sure UMRRA works as Congress intended. Again, I'm fascinated sometimes by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle who don't want to take responsibility for our actions and want to give over the running of the entire government to the executive branch. It makes absolutely no sense to me. I'm not sure why some run for office if they don't want to take on their responsibilities. Legislative and regulatory decisions should be made in consideration of all of the available information, not just part of it. The government should consider every option before imposing unnecessary burdens on the states, localities, and even private enterprise.
That's U.S. Representative Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina. She's defending the Unfunded Mandates Information and Transparency Act. The U.S. House approved the measure by a vote of 230 to 168. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It is a legal battle over money that goes back 20 years or more, and now the North Carolina School Boards Association has filed a $750 million lawsuit over funding it says should have been appropriated to technology in the state's public schools. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. He's been following the lawsuit and the issues at play here and joins us now. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
What is the basis of the lawsuit here?
The North Carolina Constitution mandates that monies from fines and forfeitures should go to public schools. And so the question really is how much of that money and where does it come from exactly that should be allocated to public schools. So in 1996, for example, there was a lawsuit that looked into this matter to determine whether civil fines and forfeitures should also be included, not just criminal fines and forfeitures, and found that, yes, that money should be included. In 1997, there was another part of the lawsuit that found that the state was excluding some fines and forfeitures that should have gone to the fund for technology. So this is an ongoing battle between the agencies that collect fines and forfeitures for public schools and those school systems that believe that they're entitled to those funds. And this really is a lawsuit that's just addressing that period between 1996 and 2005, where we had several lawsuits that looked to try to find out which funds in fines and forfeitures should be used for public schools and what that should be used for.
Those funds then came into state coffers. Okay, but they simply weren't appropriated to technology. They were used for something else?
That's right. They were diverted for other purposes. And so just to give you a sense of the agencies involved, we're talking about Health and Human Services, Employment Security Commission, transportation, all of these state agencies that collect fines and forfeitures use that money for other purposes between 1996 and 2005. Then there was a determination that they did so in violation of the Constitution, and the courts looked to see how much was diverted between that that time period, 1996 to 2005, and found that the total was close to $750 million. Now, to date, only one agency has coughed up any money toward this bill. We'll call it a bill, outstanding bill. And that was the UNC system that contributed $18 million, only a portion of what they needed to contribute to the fines and forfeitures that they were obliged to provide in that time period.
What is it the School Boards Association then is asking for as relief? They just want agencies to come up with money, or are they asking the General Assembly to just ignore the past and appropriate more money?
They want the General Assembly to force the state agencies. Well, let me step back. There are several options that the General Assembly could take here. They could raise the money themselves through any number of means or allocate it from another part of the budget and provide it to schools based on their enrollment. Or they could force state agencies to use their money to fill the gap that they failed to appropriate between 1996 and 2005. So there are several different options the General Assembly has, and the School Boards Association has gone several times to the General Assembly and has asked them to do something about this, and they have failed to do so. And the reason why they're filing a lawsuit now is that they want to renew the lawsuit for another 10 years. The final determination was made in 2008. Judgments last for 10 years. So it was in effect for until 2018. They want to extend the judgment for another 10 years.
Let's look at the timeline here, because based on the dates that you're mentioning, then this was all known many years ago about what the court had determined. So the current crop of legislative leadership really is being asked or being challenged by this lawsuit to cough up money that previous legislative leadership from a decade or more ago failed to turn over.
That's right. And not only that, that a different political party failed to turn over, because now we have a Republican-led General Assembly, but a lot of this money is owed from Democratic General Assemblies and Democratic governor who had who led state agencies that weren't paying the money that they were supposed to pay. So I think that probably has something to do with there being an unwillingness to provide these funds. Interesting angle, too, is the fact that these funds may have been repaid in 2009 or 2010 had not the Great Recession started. So there was a sense that there was going to be some repayment around the time where lots of money was flowing into our public schools. But the Great Recession happened. And so state agencies and the General Assembly saw that this was one area that they could not necessarily allocate money for.
You know, that's really curious. Now, I'm not an attorney, and I may be naive about how this works, but it seems to me that if there is a court judgment, that you don't have the choice of whether or not you comply. But they haven't complied.
That's right. And as far as I understand it, you know, often, especially in civil lawsuits, you have to take the person to court to collect what the court said you are owed.
So, says Judge Judy, and I watched those
segments.
That's
exactly right. Yeah. So, yeah. And that's really what's happening here, is that the matter about how much is owed and why it's owed has been settled. And then the School Boards Association made it very clear that they're not trying to look at the merits of the case that had already been decided in the past. They're simply suing to get the money. And they are suing with a number of school systems in order to try to come to a solution with the General Assembly to collect the money. And if they can avoid court, I think they would be more than happy to do so as long as there's a plan for paying back the money that they believe is owed to school districts.
Terry, over the past number of years then, do you recall any discussions at budget time from any legislative leaders or public school advocates, et cetera, talking about, hey, folks, you need to remember there's a judgment here, so put that money in? Or is this kind of cropping up essentially out of nowhere after being dormant?
There have been plenty of discussions about ways to pay it back. And one, for example, was a bill that would increase the fines for those who pass school buses or speed through construction zones. And a portion of those funds would go back to be paying back the $750 million that has been owed. So there have been ideas floated and bills proposed to try to find a way to pay back this money. But every time it would get down to addressing the issue of whether that should be included in the budget, it never found its way into the budget. And not only that, the School Boards Association has also asked the General Assembly on occasions to put together a committee or some sort of commission that would look at a way of paying back this debt over any number of years. And the General Assembly has not been willing to do so, probably because it's not necessarily the highest thing on their priority list, but because also I think that this is a lot of money, and they may be concerned that allocating this much money for paying back this debt would enable or make it much more difficult to pay back money, to use money for other purposes.
Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.